So yesterday, Tim spoke about loving kindness as one of the four. The word is Brahma Vihara. It's also called metta. Loving kindness is called metta in the Pali language of Southeast Asia, which is the earliest sources that we have on these earliest sources of what today we call loving kindness. And he mentioned that some definitions of the Brahma Viharas, and one that I've heard that I like is called divine abode. So metta, or loving kindness, is the first divine abode. And today I'll talk about compassion, also called karuna, which is the second divine abode. And the reason I like that is because there's not much to do when you're abiding. You're just kind of hanging out. So this idea that over time we can cultivate the ability, at least in passing moments, to feel kindness or compassion without having to do anything. We can just kind of rest in it. I really like that idea. So in the school of Buddhism that I study in, the roots of loving-kindness, or metta, it's defined basically as the desire to bring about well-being and happiness. And that's true whether we experience or practice or cultivate loving-kindness or metta for others or for ourselves. The desire to bring about well-being and happiness. And compassion, or karuna, compassion is the desire to remove harm and suffering. In modern terms, in mindfulness classes and in the self-compassion and compassion classes, we describe it that mindfulness, I'm sorry, that metta, or loving kindness, is wishing well. You know, I hope you have a good day. You know, that's loving kindness. You know, I hope that goes well for you, whatever it is you're going off to. Have a good trip. That's all loving kindness. And compassion is simply that wish when we are faced with difficulty or stress. So, towards a friend that I see, we hang out, we have a good time, I won't see them for a while, hey, take care. That's loving kindness. And for a friend who I'm with, who's having a difficult time, my wish to alleviate their suffering, for their suffering to be reduced, that's compassion. So why would we want it, right? Well, the ancient Buddhist texts that I've read, and I'm no scholar, and I haven't read a lot of them, so there's my qualifying statement there. They talk about cultivating loving kindness and compassion, specifically in the text in my lineage. They talk about radiating it in all directions, in everything that we do, and there's it's kind of strangely worded if you're not used to it, but so bear with it if it's a little bit awkward in the wording. But they talk about someone who cultivates loving kindness or compassion, and once it's present, it says here, thus she keeps pervading above, below, and all around. In every respect, the all-encompassing cosmos with an awareness imbued or filled completely with compassion, abundant, expansive, immeasurable, free from hostility, free from ill will. And I was reading that in my room as I was working on this talk, and I thought, wouldn't that be nice? You know, in all directions, immeasurable. And it goes on to say that such a practice, and they talk about it, they like to repeat. So they do the exact same phrase with loving kindness, and you read like this long thing, and then they do the exact same thing, the exact same words. The only difference is compassion is replacing loving kindness. So you kind of learn the cycle of what they're saying. And they do that phrase I read with loving kindness, and then they do it again with compassion. And it goes on to say, such a practice purifies one's mind, avoids evil-induced consequences, and leads to happiness in one's present life. The ancient texts seem to have this leaning towards a belief in the afterlife, which is definitely, in my experience, not a requirement for people who study or practice Buddhism. Certainly no more so than for anybody who practices anything that's beneficial. I tend to believe we can take what we like, and we don't have to take on a belief if it doesn't feel right. So it goes on to also say, in future lives, you'll have a great rebirth. But that doesn't speak to me as much. If it speaks to you, that's great. It speaks to a lot of my friends. But it leads to happiness in one's present life. Like, that's enough for me. Like, if it's going to make me happier, I'm interested. So it leads to happiness right here and now. And kind of stepping a little bit away from the grand cosmos, immeasurable, you know, what Tim described as kind of the radical teachings of Buddhism, and especially of early Buddhism, bringing a little bit more down to what probably relates more to most of our day-to-day experiences. In the classes, there's two very popular and four or five increasingly popular classes out there in the Western world around compassion. The one I'm most familiar with is Mindful Self-Compassion. And in these classes, and in the research, it shows that practicing compassion actually can and does lead to increased happiness. It leads to increased well-being. It can lead, in many cases, to less anxiety, less depression, less negative mood, less sense of overwhelm in general. I heard that, and I was interested. I don't know if I know anybody who doesn't experience one or more of these things at times. And the research, though it's not just the practice and the feeling that we can get at times, but also the research is bearing it out too. The parts of the brain that are associated with well-being and a sense of okayness, they get more activated when we practice compassion. And we can see this good feeling in ourselves. When we teach self-compassion, what we're really trying to teach is a felt sense of it. And I'm guessing some of you have had a felt sense of perhaps kindness or calmness, maybe self-kindness. I'm not saying like, did you flip a switch and all of a sudden, halfway through your first day here, everything was great. But for some of us, there might have been moments where, you know, it's not quite as much of a struggle just for this second. Sometimes it gets lost because the next second it is a struggle. But we probably all had glimpses of moments when, that seemed a little bit less problematic for a moment. Don't know what that was. And then our mind takes us back to the problem. And we're going for the felt sense of it. One example of this, I mentioned in one of the meditations yesterday, the loving kindness, is this idea of non-hassling. Right? Most of us understand what it feels like when we expect to be hassled or bothered, and then we're not. I mean, it can be as simple as a strange example that just popped into my mind. As simple as one thing that causes me nervousness is if I have to return something. I hate doing it, even if it's unopened. I don't know why, it's just something. And when I go, and the person behind the counter is completely chill about it, I feel such a sense of relief. I feel happy. and it happens in our personal lives, we know that feeling, right? That feeling in the body of not being bothered. That's the felt sense of happiness. And we can learn and cultivate the felt sense of kindness. That's receiving someone's kindness. And we can learn that felt sense when we do it for ourselves. And we can also learn the felt sense of what it feels like when we extend kindness. And we probably all know that feeling to some degree too. Think of something kind you've done for somebody else. Just think of that part of the story, not like, oh, they didn't return the favor, or yeah, but years later. Just the part where you did something nice for somebody. Can you feel how that feels good? It feels wholesome is the word they like to use. And so if kindness, in a sense, is somewhat related to this idea of non-hassling, then compassion is simply non-hassling in the face of difficulty. So if I'm the store clerk and I'm practicing compassion, I'm practicing kindness, you walk in, hey, can I return this? Sure. Yeah, that's kindness. You walk in and you're really not doing well. You know, you're really, you know, just something's not okay with you. And I'm just as kind. And I'm just as, you know, bothered. That has an effect on the other person too. And that's me practicing compassion. So again, being hassled, not being hassled is nice. Not being hassled when you're expecting to be hassled or feeling on edge is even nicer. And in the face of difficulty, right, it feels especially nice not to be bothered. It also feels nice not to be told what to do or how to fix the situation, as if that ever works, how to fix the feeling. Like, I have a feeling I don't like. I still do this. I try a million ways to get rid of the feeling, and I've never succeeded, right? And with other people, right, when we're in conversation, we don't want to be told often what to do. We just want someone to listen. How nice does it feel when someone says, wow, I'm really sorry you're feeling that way. Yeah, I'm here with you. I mean, I get a little moved just saying that. And so part of what we do with self-compassion is we learn little by little to do that for ourselves, to not hassle ourselves when we're having a hard time. Another reason why we might want to cultivate compassion is because it helps us to not get lost in the other person's difficulty or in our own difficulty. There's a difference between compassion, right, which is me being kind in the face of my or another's suffering, and being lost and pulled into the suffering. How useful would it be? How useful is it to see that difference and to cultivate an ability to kind of be where we are, not be lost, but still be with? Tim mentioned the fact that these Brahma Viharas, these divine abodes, have a near enemy and a far enemy that are helpful to understand. And so with compassion, the near enemy is pity, right? So it's good to understand the difference between pity and caring for the concern, wishing someone well when they're having a difficult time. The far enemy, just to mention it, is cruelty. Right? But we're not going to mistake cruelty for compassion, but we might mistake pity for compassion. And pity, really, if you pay attention to it, pity doesn't feel very good. It's got this, I'm better than you kind of feel to it sometimes. And there's this separation that happens if we pay real close attention to it. But in practical terms, whether you're a caregiver in the work you do, or just in your friendships, or in your life, in a personal way, most of us will be at some point, if we aren't, you know, children, friends, family, jobs. It's really useful, and we'll talk more about this later in the week, to cultivate compassion and to understand the difference between compassion and being lost, falling forward into the other person's suffering. And that happens a lot, you know, when people are facing major illnesses or end-of-life issues. It's really easy. I've worked with a lot of people in those situations. It's really common, and it's not unusual, that the person who's ill or dying feels that they need to care for their friends and family even more because their friends and family are having a harder time with what's going on than they are. And it's such a gift. It's such a simple thing, but it's such a gift to say to somebody who's having difficulty, I know you're having difficulty, and I'm not trying to take that away, and I'm here with you. I mean, that's some of the most powerful things that you can say to people who are having difficulty. So, that's a little bit about what it is and why we might want it. How do we get it, right? And there's lots of different ideas about this. One nice thing is that you're all already cultivating it without even necessarily knowing it. Because both loving kindness and compassion are byproducts of meditation practice. They're byproducts of mindfulness, of just paying attention with the intention to allow and accept and be non-judgmental. And even if there doesn't seem to be a lot of that, the intention is enough. Like that Sharon Salzberg story. You don't even know what's happening. So exploring our own inner life, sitting down and noticing what's happening and trying to be with it, even though our intention is not to cultivate compassion and kindness necessarily, that's a byproduct. So you're all cultivating compassion and kindness here. Mindfulness helps us to let go. The key mindfulness helps us to let go. And letting go, right, when those moments, slowly over time, when there's moments when there isn't the internal argument and dialogue about what I should be, we just let ourselves be even for a moment. In that space, compassion and kindness arise on its own. In a sense, we're setting the conditions for compassion to arise or for kindness to arise. And sometimes it arises and sometimes it doesn't. It's like planting seeds and watering them. You don't decide how fast they grow. You can't encourage them to grow faster necessarily by talking to them or by pushing them or telling them to hurry up. And sometimes we get a lovely tomato plant, and sometimes nothing grows there. We didn't do anything. We just put the seed in, but all the conditions came together, our part and the conditions that are beyond our control. And with practice, we're setting the conditions that increase the likelihood that kindness and compassion and happiness and a sense of okayness arise, seemingly on their own. But we're putting in the effort. It's just not an A, B. It's not like, well, today I'll do this practice and I'm sure I'll feel this way. I wish. And we have to have a certain amount of trust and curiosity because it doesn't work in a linear way. I know of one teacher, I don't know this teacher, but I've heard him quoted many times before. His name is Achan Cha, and the conversation was about how to judge your practice, right? How to assess it. Now, there are ways to assess it, and it's useful to assess it at times. But his point, you'll understand, he said, oh, it's great to look back and assess your practice and how you're doing. Just don't do it on anything less than a 5-year span. I think about that sometimes in the middle of a sit, when I'm rolling my eyes at my experience thinking, this is absolutely not doing anything. Right? And I think, oh, 5 years, what do I know? So one of the ways that kindness and compassion can arise during practice has to do with the key question of mindfulness. We like to say the key question of mindfulness is what's happening right now. And if you can answer that question, even if the answer is, I'm having a horrible time and my mind is going all over the place, you're practicing mindfulness. And if we sit enough, right, the mind settles at times, not every time, but it does. It settles a little bit more, and over time we see a little bit more where there's stress or worry or planning. And we might even see how natural this is. All minds do this. And we learn over time to be present with it. Oh, there's planning. Oh, there's worry. Oh, there's stress. And if we're lucky every now and then, oh, there's a moment of relaxation. Oh, that's gone. Yeah. And we're present with the intention of non-judging, allowing and being with, not fixing, not just noticing. And that is a tremendous act of kindness. And shifting a little bit, maybe another way that we cultivate compassion. Let me leave that for a moment. Another way to cultivate compassion is literally through the intention to cultivate it. We sit down and we say, I'm going to do a compassion cultivation practice. And again, that's similar to what I was saying a moment ago. We're not sitting down and saying, I'm going to throw the switch, I'll throw the compassion switch. Should take about 15 minutes. I should get my compassion cooking and I'll be cruising, I'll be compassionate. Yeah, I'll call you back in 15 when I can talk better, you know? I wish, you know? We all wish. But we're setting conditions that increase the likelihood that compassion or kindness arise. Like we did yesterday with loving kindness. It doesn't matter if you could feel kindness towards yourself or another, but could you connect with the wish that you do wish others well? Even if you couldn't tap into it. It's almost like we have to learn to set the intention and then just let go and then be with whatever arises and notice what is actually happening. So I might sit down some days to practice compassion and I might try to practice it towards somebody I probably shouldn't practice it towards in the moment that I'm feeling like I want to be able to. And the best I can hope for then is to notice, oh, this isn't working. And to notice what's happening. Oh, what's the feeling like when it's not working? Rather than trying to force myself to feel something I don't feel, I set the intention and then I just be present for what is happening. We learn to lessen the resistance to what is actually happening. And we also notice how we get lost and we come back, and that has a tremendous value as well. It's really quite simple at its heart. And we don't need to access the feeling each time we practice it. It's still beneficial. We're still setting the conditions. We're planting more seeds we're increasing the quality of the soil, and we're getting more and more fresh water and sunshine. We're creating the conditions. And no matter how it feels when we're practicing, whether it's mindfulness or one of the cultivation practices, like loving kindness or compassion, there isn't a moment of having sincerity and intention that's ever wasted. One teacher that I've listened to a lot says something like, all we really need is sincere approach, yes, I really want to do this, and a gentle effort. And everything else is almost secondary. If we're sincere, yes, I would like to be more peaceful, happier, kind, and we're willing to make a gentle effort and keep returning to that, no matter what happens, we're slowly but surely moving towards more happiness, more kindness. And no amount of mindfulness or the intention to cultivate kindness is ever wasted. Even if it looks like you're having a bad sit. Some of the worst periods of my practice that I couldn't wait for them to get over have ended up being the ones that really were the most beneficial to me. And I've heard that from many, many people. We just don't know. We have to have a little bit of trust. And one thing I heard that I love is if you don't feel a lot of trust or confidence, you can borrow it from somebody. You can borrow ours. Tim and I are happy to share ours. We have a tremendous amount of trust and confidence in these practices. And I've borrowed trust and confidence many, many times. So back to this idea that compassion is simply kindness in the face of difficulty. And like the example of non-hassling, we learn to let ourselves be. Learn to just be with ourselves without trying to do anything other than just be with what is. And by practicing that over time, self-kindness develops. It kind of sneaks in. It was right here in this room, I don't know how many years ago, 5, 6 years ago, I heard a teacher, forget her last name, Heather, she lives in British Columbia, and she said that she started practicing meditation and went to these really fairly strict retreats, where you learn just how to focus on one thing and block the world out, and you get super, super concentrated. And she was super competitive about it and was really into it. And she was really proud of how good she was at it. She had a young child, and she would arrange for a month, once or twice a year, for someone to care for her child so she could go and be this awesome, totally focused meditator. She said she would sit in the room on these retreats. They're very somber. They actually, this particular style of retreat, if you don't come to a sitting, they come to your room and check in on you. Like, you gotta be there. It's kind of scared me, I've never gone. But, so she did this, and she was about 10 years into her practice, and she was sort of, you know, being groomed to learn to teach this particular style. She was, you know, it helped her with a lot of things. But mostly she'd feel really emboldened about how great she was at it. And she was pretty sure that others weren't able to focus as well, and it was good that she could focus that well. She really wasn't seeing anything else about anybody else. And she said she was sitting there one day in the meditation hall, and she had a thought. Something like, oh, you know, I hope the person next to her was making noise or doing something, I forget the details. But she had a kind thought towards them, which it was not her nature, she said. She had a kind thought, And then she noticed it. And then she realized that she was wishing everybody in the room well. And her first thought was, oh no, really? And then she realized that that was a beautiful thing. You know, she wasn't even trying to cultivate kindness and compassion. She was just trying to settle her mind and be a little more peaceful within herself. So compassion is simply the kindness that grows as we learn to be with whatever is difficult or uncomfortable. Or even like knee pain, you know? It's not soldiering on, I'm gonna go get through this, that bell's gonna ring soon, maybe I can speed it up if I think hard, right? It's actually, well, okay, I'll shift, but before I do, can I just be with it for a moment? Yeah, well, that's a drag. Yeah, that I feel buzzing. Oh, look, it's kind of moving around. Can I just be with the experience? That's an act of kindness, even for a moment. And it feeds off itself and grows over time. Not by soldiering on, but by coming back to noticing what's actually happening. With some openness or kindness, or perhaps, like for many of us, just with a little bit less resistant for just a moment. That's enough. And the last thing I want to talk about in terms of ways to cultivate compassion is specifically related to self-compassion, starting with ourselves. And there's a lot of myths around why that's a bad thing to do. You know, we could be perceived as selfish, right? People won't like us if we're kind to ourselves. You know, you walk into the room, I'm feeling so good about myself, I really like myself. You're like, who's this? Someone walks in, it's like, oh, I'm having such a hard day. You're like, oh yeah, really, me too. Like, we sort of connect. And there's all these myths, and one by one, the research has shown that none of these things are true about people who rate high on the self-compassion scale, or who practice self-compassion and exhibit over time more and more skills around self-compassion. The research actually shows that the other big myth is that we'll be weak, right? I mean, I gotta push myself to accomplish. People who are self-compassionate achieve more because they're not afraid of failure, right? Oh, whoopsie, that didn't work, okay. They are actually more resilient, not weaker. They rebound better from difficult experiences. And this was the real surprising part to me, right? They're way more compassionate with others, even if they're not cultivating that. So when you cultivate self-compassion, the byproduct is compassion towards others. And it seems counterintuitive that the way to cultivate compassion is by actually learning to meet our own suffering. Buddhists like to talk about suffering, but I like all these other words like stress or tension or difficulty. It's the same thing, really. So the way to cultivate compassion is to learn to see and be with our own suffering or difficulty or stress. They make a joke in self-compassion classes that they could have called it, getting to know your own suffering, but nobody would sign up if you advertised it that way. But it's really essential. If you want to learn how to meet something, right, you've got to know what it is. You've got to be able to recognize it. It doesn't mean that we dive head first into the depths of our most difficult things. In fact, it's not even required. But if we're going to learn to be kind to ourselves when we're having difficulty, the first step is to be able to recognize that we're having difficulty. So self-compassion, the way it's taught in the circles that I'm in, is comprised of three things. And I'll explain them, and then we'll do a little practice to end. So the first step is mindfulness, meaning you need to be mindful enough to notice, oh, I'm having a moment of difficulty. Right? I'm suffering in some way. I'm tense in some way. The second component of self-compassion is understanding and reminding yourself that every human being suffers. Every human being has difficulty. And it's amazing how in a moment of difficulty, for some of us, it's really nice to remember that we're not alone in our suffering. I don't know, are we up to 8 billion people? I don't know how many people we have on the earth now, but there's literally, you know, probably hundreds of millions of people at any given moment feeling something similar, their own style of it. And at first I thought it was a little strange when I was practicing self-compassion to say, you know, oh, everyone suffers. But the more I do it, the more I realize for me that, you know, it's nice to know, because one of the difficult parts of difficult experiences is feeling like we're the only ones who have it. And even if I don't know these people in the moment, I'm not talking to them, to know that it's part of the human condition. One teacher likes to say, oh, it's easy to avoid suffering, just don't be born. Right? Difficulty and pain is a byproduct of being alive. But it doesn't have to be something that carries us away and that we reinforce through resistance and pushing against and forcing and reacting to. I mean, it will be all those things too, but we can soften all of those. And it can be something that we can use as a trigger. So mindfully knowing we're having difficulty, reminding ourselves, oh, all beings experience difficulty. This is just my moment in this way right now. And then we actually do something to generate some kindness towards ourselves. So compassion, luckily we're mammals, and compassion can actually be evoked in mammals or increase the likelihood of its arising with three things. The first is warmth. The second is touch. Think of a newborn. What calms them down? Oftentimes it's being held, right? There's touch and there's warmth. And that's one of the reasons why it's encouraged to literally just place your hand somewhere that feels okay and feel the warmth of your own hand. You're getting two of the three conditions that cause compassion to arise. And I invite you to try that. If you put your hand on your leg, just literally just tune into the temperature of your hand. You don't have to try to do anything else. Feel the feeling of your hand and the temperature of your hand. Gentle sounds are the third thing, soothing sounds. And when we're pre-verbal, we don't know what's being said, but we can tell if they're soothing or not. Right? And it evokes compassion in the parent when they do that. And so we'll do a very short, what's called a self-compassion break. There's recordings online, they take 10, 12 minutes. There's also 30 and 60 second versions. It doesn't need to work for you, it's just an experiment. So kind of with a curious attitude, I invite you to make yourself comfortable. You're welcome to shift. And I'm going to just bank on the fact that if I said, raise your hand if when you have difficulty, you wish you had more of it, right? Then no one would raise their hand, okay? So we all have the wish not to feel difficulty, right? So that's just a wish. That doesn't mean we have the ability to make the difficulty go away. But the important thing is, what do we wish for ourselves? So perhaps remembering, and depending on how you're feeling right now, you can just tap into the feeling, some aspect or experience of difficulty. But don't make it, you know, the most difficult thing. On a scale of 1 to 10, pick a 3 or a 4. You know, it kind of bothers you, but it's not like the thing. It's really important because you're learning a skill. You're not trying to solve anything. So you don't start learning piano by having somebody put a Beethoven concerto in front of you. You start with just a couple of simple notes. So think of something, you know, just bothers you a little bit. I wish my knee didn't hurt so much. I'm not able to exercise as much as I usually do. It's too hot or too cold. And just bring a little bit of mindfulness, enough to notice, oh, that's some difficulty, some unpleasantness, a mild discomfort or stress, whatever the word is. This is some form of, I wish it wasn't so. Just enough to tap into the feeling. And then we respond to the feeling and say to yourselves in whatever way makes sense to you, that all beings experience difficulty and conditions that they don't like or that are difficult, pressures and stresses. And just like all beings, I'm experiencing some difficulty in this moment. Just acknowledging the common humanity of it. And now, if you're comfortable placing your hand, you can put it on your heart, you can hold your hands together. You don't have to do this part of it at all if it doesn't feel comfortable. You can just touch the tips of your fingers if that's what feels nice. And just notice the warmth. Don't try to do anything, but notice the warmth. The mind wanders, come back to the warmth, the contact, and see if there's some wish, some genuine wish to alleviate your own difficulty. Not a plan or an expectation, but a wish. And you might try saying it to yourself the way you would to a friend. Or if it's easier, think of what you would say to a friend who is having the same experience. It's often easier to tap into our self-compassion by first tapping into our compassion for others. Oh, I'm sorry you're feeling that way. I wish you didn't feel that way. I wish I knew what to do, but at least I'm here with you. What would you want to hear from a friend? Can you offer those words to yourself? And letting that go. Knowing that you can tap into the wish for yourself whenever you like. And if these practices are new to you, we'll make sure to send you a link to places where you can find them online when you get home. For now, letting that practice go and just letting yourself be however you are right now. What's the best you can do right now, just in this moment, in terms of non-hassling? Just letting yourself be. It may be a lot, it may be a little. It changes from day to day. But right now, can you let yourself be just a little bit? Just in this moment. Thank you for the gift of your kind attention.